In the Wild West world of podcasting, there is one podcast that is authentic and genuine and continues to stand tall in its originality. Based on a passion for his guests, their work, and his love of podcasting, Derek Thomas and Monday Morning Critic Podcast get amazing, diverse, unique guests found nowhere else. They include Hall of Fame athletes, Academy Award winners, Golden Globe winners, Super Bowl champions, Emmy winners, award-winning authors, award-winning film score composers, directors, trailblazers, pioneers, and inventors. The variety and quality are endless. There is something for everyone. Derek Thomas is the hero you deserve. He's a silent guardian, a watchful protector. Welcome to Monday Morning Critic Podcast. Here is Derek Thomas.
Is Trisha here?
Oh, I'm sorry, she's not. She's at a friend's house right now.
Well, hey, Napoleon. Napoleon's my nephew.
Oh, that's nice.
Could you just give this to her for me?
I certainly could.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Poor kid. I've been taking care of him while his grandma's in the hospital. He still wits the bed and everything.
You're kidding.
Yeah, he's a tender little guy. He still gets beat up and whatnot. So we still feeling pretty good about this 32-piece set here.
Welcome to episode 231 of Monday Morning Critic Podcast. That scene you heard coming in was from Napoleon Dynamite. My next guest had a part in that, and she has a long and a strong filmography. She's an absolutely wonderful actor. We're going to get into Napoleon Dynamite in a moment. She has many parts, which include a lot of Star Wars animation as Captain Phasma. We go into that in our interview. Just a really great discussion. But the part that I love most with Ellen in it is Napoleon Dynamite. So we're approaching the 20-year anniversary for Napoleon Dynamite. We're probably at like 16 or 17. I believe it's a 2004 release. So, you know, we're getting up there. We're getting close to that 20-year monumental kind of anniversary. And, you know, I look at comedies today, and I've been on this tangent before, and I'm not going to go on it again. But, I mean, I am just so hard-pressed to find a really good comedy. And I'm not talking about episodic shows. Those seem to be fine, right? You have Schitt's Creek. You have a bunch of other things. Those work. But I'm talking about a movie. I think the last comedic movie I gave a chance to was Bad Trip with Eric Andre. And I just... To me, comedy isn't, let's be as zany and as crazy as we can, and let's piece a movie together, right? Because that's what the Jackass guys did. I mean, supposedly Bad Trip was supposed to have a storyline and a plot. It was a tough ride through, literally through that movie. It was very difficult to watch. You know, I think, and if you watch Eric Andre's talk show, it's one of the best things I've ever seen on television. So it's like, how do you go from the genius of the Eric Andre talk show to Bad Trip? It really was a bad trip. I mean, it was tough to finish. And I usually don't have very much difficulty finishing movies. But I will say that what makes Napoleon Dynamite really, really special is it has a wonderful story. It touches your heart. You can't stop laughing. Every freaking character in the movie is so likable. You walk away feeling really good. I mean, when was the last time you really felt like that way about a comedy? Okay, you know, take away the last year because, you know, the movie theaters weren't up to capacity. But in a normal movie going year, when was the last time you were at a theater and said, "Wow, that's a fantastic comedy"? Or on Netflix? I mean, for me, it's been a long, long time. So I have to say, I have a very special place in my heart for Napoleon Dynamite. For me personally, it's certainly in my top 5 to 10 in that 20-year time span. No question about it. It's so original. There's no real, I mean, is it from the 70s? Is it from the 80s? Is it from the 90s? Napoleon Dynamite kind of drops like, you really can't pinpoint what time period it's from. I mean, part of the movie looks like it is from the 70s. Part looks like it's from the 80s. And that's what makes it so unique and so special and so awesome. Every character is cast perfectly. I'm just in love with this movie. And I was really blessed to have Ellen join me on the show. And, you know, And this will be the last thing I say before I direct you to the interview. You know, to have a comedy, it's got to reach a place for you. It's got to be iconic. It's got to have those quotable lines. It's got to, I mean, how many quotable lines do you know from Napoleon Dynamite? It's every, you know, 16, 17 years later, people are still quoting this movie daily. You know, and I mentioned Bad Trip before, and I certainly don't like talking poorly about other movies. But in comparison, you compare that to like Borat. Borat has an awesome story. Yeah, there's zany stuff happening. There's crazy stuff happening. But it's supplemented by this wonderful narrative and storyline. It's a little cheesy, yes, but it works on so many levels. And it's Sacha Baron Cohen at its best. And if you really want to see a lot of Sacha Baron Cohen, Ali G Show that was on HBO is some of his best work. I don't think I've ever laughed so hard. But you know, comedies are getting to be a really rare thing. Watching a good one, a really rare thing. And boy, does Napoleon Dynamite is one of the last of the real great ones. If you're looking to contact me or follow me, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts. I would really appreciate that. Also, you can find me on Facebook at Monday Morning Critic Podcast, Instagram, Monday Morning Critic Podcast, my website, mmcpodcast.com. I'm all over the place. I would love a follow, a subscribe, whatever is easiest and best for you if you feel like I warrant that. There are lots of wonderful interviews coming up. I have 10 recorded. I have 2 more this week, 1 over the weekend, 3 next week. So there is a lot of content to get out there. I might start doubling up the interviews each week, go 2 each week instead of 1 a week. I think you're going to like the quality of who I'm about to introduce you to. The guests that I have, I think you're going to really appreciate it. Significant guests in my life who have affected me with their work on television, in television, and in the movies. And I think they've affected a lot of people. And I think you'll appreciate who I introduce to you. And no more than my next guest, Ellen Dubin, just a wonderful person to talk to. I really felt there's a time when you interview somebody, and I don't know if you have podcasts or you don't, or you're familiar with it. When you really get comfortable and you feel like you're talking to a friend, you feel like you have a good vibe with that person, the interview is so smooth, and 40 minutes, 45 minutes go by in a blink. And sometimes people look at interviews and they say, well, that looks like a long interview. I'm telling you, when I have these 45, 50-minute interviews, sometimes longer, with somebody that is, and all my guests are interesting, but somebody that is so easy to talk to like Ellen is, you just lose track of time. It's just like, how did that happen? And I'm looking at my recording equipment, and it's reading, 45 minutes. I'm like, I've kept this poor woman on the interview for almost an hour. So it's easy to lose track when you talk to somebody as wonderful as Ellen. I'm so blessed to have these guests come on, and I'm so blessed to have you listening. And spread the word if you feel like I deserve it again. Thank you so much for listening. Without further ado, please welcome the wonderful actor, Ellen Dubin. My next guest is an actor whose filmography includes Midway, Napoleon Dynamite, and a multitude of Star Wars projects. She is the actor's actor. Please welcome Ellen Dubin. Ellen, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Of course. I can't wait to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
So I have to say, for those listening, you're born in Toronto. And I will say this, and I've had many Canadian guests on the show. People who have resided and grew up in Canada have never let me down. They are some of the nicest people on the planet.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Oh, I appreciate that. So, well, it must be the nice cold air. Keeps us on our toes. I don't know. Keeps us loyal.
So you were born in Toronto. Do you still reside there? Are you still in Canada? Where are you spending your life? Do you frequent Canada often? Is it? I know you're there now, but is it where you consider home?
Good question. I used to say home is where my suitcase is placed. I was on the road so much as an actor doing theater and, you know, just traveling to different countries to work on movies. I'd still say the place that I was born, yes, Toronto is my home, but I spent a great deal of my time in Los Angeles. So I have an apartment in Los Angeles and one in Toronto. So both. I'm able to, because of work, hang in the U.S. and Canada. But right now I'm here because of COVID, looking after my mom and hanging with my mom. Oh, that's my bubble. They call it the bubble, right?
Yes. Here?
Yeah.
I've heard nothing but beautiful things about Toronto. It's definitely on, once some of this clears, To do my bucket list, I guess you could say, because I've heard some beautiful things about Toronto. So that being said, just getting into your life a little bit here, you know, I know ballet is a big part of your life early on, as is theater and Shakespeare. Talk about really putting your time in, Ellen. Geez, to say you've done that might be an understatement.
You know, when people talk about in the business how they pay their dues, you've heard that probably from a lot of actors. I mean, when you're starting out, you don't think about paying your dues. I still strive to learn. I'm like a curious child, which I think is really important as a performer to always keep that. Yeah, you get a little cynical now and then, but I always like that sense of wonder. So when I was studying ballet, I go, what's it like to tap? What's it like to do jazz? What's it like to sing? What's it like, you know? So I was always trying to learn new things. And, you know, I think that really contributed to my discipline as a performer and always, you know, trying to learn more. So yeah, when I think about it, how you just put it, thank you for reminding me about my past, is, you know, I did kind of put my hands in a lot of things, but ballet was my goal in life, to be a ballet dancer. And it's sort of funny how I ended up in ballet. Is I call it flat foot syndrome. I had bad flat feet, and my mother wanted me to have, you know, better walking skills and better arches. And Dad used to drive me to ballet every weekend, and I wasn't very confident, and so they wanted me to have, you know, more social skills. I was this crazy tall skinny nerd, you know, the nerdy girl, and I just wasn't very, not that I wasn't friendly, but I was too shy to reach out. So ballet gave me that venue to have better arches, straight back, confidence. And when I was on the stage doing ballet, that's where I truly became confident. I could hide behind or reveal myself. You could look at it both ways, and be more confident. So yeah, I did a lot of things in the beginning to get to where I am now, but it's all helped, Derek. When I look back, everything is a building block, a foundation.
Yeah, and we're going to get into, you know, the introduction of your actor. I really believe that, because you do virtually everything, where some actors kind of are focused on one thing, and that's not like a bad thing, but, you know, your body of work is certainly encompasses a lot of areas. And I know you said everything kind of has, that you've done in your life, it's all played a part. Is there one that stands out more than the rest, Ellen? Is there something that you learned early on or did early on where it kind of, you find yourself thinking about it often, or is it kind of, as you said, a potpourri of things?
It's a potpourri of things, you know, mixed together in a nice recipe. But I honestly go back to the dance and the ballet, because it was classical ballet training. It's like training for the Olympics if you want to be a dancer or a gymnast or a singer or even an actor, really. But people forget, because you think as an actor you're just talking, but that's a whole other topic. But no, that's not true. So I think the discipline of being in a studio, watching the older dancers, paying attention to all the different teachers, it's taught me that when I was in the theater, I would, even if I wasn't rehearsing my scene, I would watch the other actors, especially the older actors, because you learn from the pros, from the older experienced actors. And it's something that's really important. And a lot of younger actors don't want to sit around and watch older actors now. And it's a shame, because that gave me the discipline. Being in the ballet gave me the discipline to work hard, to stay longer, come earlier, observe. So yeah, I think it really shaped the way I work as an actor in every medium.
Yeah, I got to say, to me, it's absolute insanity if you're a younger actor and you have these veteran actors that you could be learning from, and you're choosing to neglect it, to not get there early, to not observe. To me, that is, I don't want to go over the top, but it's severe career detriment. I mean, to do that is insane to me.
It is. It's a free lesson. I mean, yes, you can, and I took many wonderful acting classes and had fabulous acting teachers, but the best lesson is when you're on your feet and you're watching and you're observing and you're doing. That's really important.
Yeah, and you know, they're filming by my home. They're filming the new season of Dexter. It's Shelburne Falls. It's a beautiful area. And there's so many people around watching the filming process and how it unfolds. My God, if fans can watch it, if you're on set, you should even be more glued into what's going on, or tuned into what's going on. I don't know. I think, what an opportunity squandered, if that's the way some people choose to approach it, Ellen.
It is an opportunity squandered, for sure. And also, because I'm not very good technologically, I like to watch the lighting guys or the sound guys. Mm. You know, all we, you know, you forget how important, without the, you know, the crew and people, you know, they forget the crew because they're not on camera. But those, to me, are the unsung heroes. Those are the stars for me. So watching them work and contributing to the whole, whether it's on stage as a stage manager or prop master or a wardrobe person or whoever does your shoes, you know, everything contributes to the whole. So watch everybody who's listening. Watch who's at work with you. It's very important.
Well said. You know, and I'm going to bounce around a little bit here. I know you know who John Cena is, wrestler. Now making his way into acting. I have to say, so I buy into him as a comedic actor. I'm not really high on him as a dramatic actor, but that's just me, and I'm going somewhere with this. But one of the things I absolutely love about this man, I mean, I love about this man, is his work with children and Make-A-Wish. And he has fulfilled so many kids' dreams, and you know what he's done is immeasurable. It's off the charts. And I know you have done work with Make-A-Wish, which is why I bring this up. Please say anything you want about your Make-A-Wish experience and what it's meant to you.
Oh, I'm pausing here because I'm getting teary-eyed thinking about the last event I did for them, and I don't think the girl is around anymore. I'll tell you a quick story, and this is sort of sums it up. I hosted a huge event several years ago to raise money. It was an auction with, you know, jewelry and clothes and cars, and it was a very wonderful, attentive crowd and huge ballroom, several thousand people. And there was a point in the program where I'm supposed to introduce the young woman who has since passed. She was, I think, 14 and had cancer, a very terminal cancer. And she wasn't supposed to be introduced for maybe another hour into the show. And I watched her. She was standing backstage watching me, observing. Here we go. Mm. And I decided, my improv skills came in handy, to go off the program. There was a teleprompter. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, I want to bring out blah, blah, to help me with the auction. She wasn't supposed to be a part of the auction, but I had it in my head that people must meet this wonderful young woman and put a face or a name to the face and see her. I can talk about her and you know, all I want, but she was so happy. She participated. I said, let's put the ring on. Okay, what do I hear? Do I have a bit of this? Or that? What do you think of the ring, honey? And we ad-lib like a comedic team. And it made my day. And I started in the middle crying. And she says on mic, why are you crying, Ellen? And I said, because, I just, you know, honey, it's just, and I couldn't even get it out what I wanted to say. And I didn't want to say. And she says, that's okay. I'm having a good time right now. Mm. And that's everything. Mm. And everybody should enjoy their lives right now. That night changed my life. I was happy that I did the improv, but the most important thing was that we made a lot of money.
Good.
But after that, there was just like, it just was the most mesmerizing moment to show, and especially now with what we're going on in the world, this little 14-year-old little girl, she was a tiny little thing, and she just stopped the crowd by saying, enjoy your life now. And that to me, if a kid can educate an adult, a room full of adults, that summed it up for me working with Make-A-Wish, because she taught all of us that life is precious and life is important. And we know that intellectually, and we can say that. We can all say that, but that really summed it up. And I love kids. Mm. I've always loved kids. I don't have kids of my own, but I love kids. I taught ballet to kids, and I love just their truth, what comes out of their mouth. There's the most humane humans. They don't lie. They don't lie. And that to me was just a mind-blowing moment for me. And that's part of the reason why I worked with Make-A-Wish.
No, that's beautiful. And you know, just, you know, piggybacking on what you've said and what John Cena has done, I just don't know. I think that's part of it, looking outside looking in, that would be the most difficult for me, right? To when my dad passed, I believe we gave in his memory to Make-A-Wish. I believe that, or it was a children's hospital. It was very similar, and and it was like I just to be surrounded by that. It's you're doing a lot of good, but it does not weigh on you. That's a bad way of saying it. It's difficult.
It's very difficult, and you feel like you're looking at somebody, and I mean, we're all going to die, but you're looking at somebody terminal, like very terminal, and their attitude is completely not what you would expect. So it kind of inspires you to push through, not dwell on the maudlin, and enjoy the moment, enjoy their, you know, it's ironic because I work a lot for Disney. The biggest wish is for the kids to go to Disneyland. You know, I had wishes, you know, where they wanted to play with their major, you know, their favorite baseball player or, you know, get all the ice cream they can eat. But number one wish for Make-A-Wish is to go to Disneyland or Disney World. Isn't that interesting, Gary?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I can see why, because the experience they provide. Okay, so it's like a child taking their brain out of their head and kind of just enjoying, just soaking up all that wonderfulness. And I think that's why it's appealing to adults, too, because you get a chance to escape the real world. I absolutely get it, Ellen. I get it. Yeah. And they do wonderful things too, Disney, by the way. I should be saying that too. With a lot of these charities and charitable work.
We're very good for Make-A-Wish. They supplied a lot of free trips, and the family gets to go with them too, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and I believe in many cases they put up the housing. I mean, it's just some wonderful things. And speaking of, you know, working with people, I know before the pandemic hit, you were big into Comic-Cons. I covered many for my podcast, and you strike me as the person. So there's two types of people I feel like that go to Comic-Cons that are celebrities, right? There's the person that goes to kind of, I'll do it. I'm going to collect it, you know, my well-earned money and leave. And there's a type that's really enthusiastic, loves being there with the fans, and just loves the moment. You strike me as the latter, somebody who just loves being with the fans.
My convention agent says, Ellen, this person has been sitting beside you in your booth for 3 hours. You need to get her out of there. Oh, we're just talking about her family. Get her out. Go. That's why I need a wrangler, because it's not for the fans. It's for me, Derek. I am so bad. I'll go, oh, come sit down. She goes, no, that's not safe. Oh, this is before COVID, by the way.
Right.
But, come on, come sit down and enjoy yourself. And they're like, what? Okay. So, yes, I'm definitely the enthusiastic, over-enthusiastic fan. But I'm a fan.
But that must mean the world to you when somebody says, you know what, your work, you know, has made my life better, even in some little way, right? So that's just got to feel really good, I imagine, from your end.
100%. It's actually, you know, to me, it's one of the number, I mean, yes, I get a lot of gratification playing certain parts, but it's really one of the reasons why you do this. When a fan comes up to you and can quote the whole episode of a show, or when you said this and you took the cup of coffee and you put it to the kitchen, did that symbolize that the devil was going to, no, I just put the cup of coffee. Oh no, because I saw that it was the rebirth of the devil when he came here and did that. And I'm like, okay. That's really interesting. So they sometimes see more things in your performance or in your scripts than ever before. Yeah, it's truly about them. It really is.
Yeah, and it's so great to see people look so happy with you. There's just it's a wonderful thing to witness. Is there a dream, quote unquote, gig, right? Because I mentioned before when I introduced you and then again later that, you know, you've done quite a bit in the wide array of potential acting opportunities, right? You've done voiceovers, you've done movies, TV, commercial, all that other stuff. Is there one that's a dream gig? I had Austin Pendleton, who was in Finding Nemo.
I listened to the interview. He's one of my favorites, by the way. When I saw that, I went to that one first. Brilliant.
Yeah, and he makes it sound like he did the voice in Nemo. He makes it sound like it was very, very difficult. I mean, he's a big theater guy, so I get interaction is huge with him, because he made it sound like you have to say the same lines over and over and over. And he
I heard that. Yeah.
So do you find it the same way? Because you've done a lot. I mean, and we're going to talk about your work here in animation and voiceover. Do you feel that do you enjoy it? Is it tedious to you?
You know, it's interesting. I understand his point of view, because I also come from the theater and I love having the chemistry working off of various actors. But I actually find something interesting about it in terms of the challenge of creating the world by myself, reacting against the other actor. Am I undersea? Am I on a mountain? I have to create the space. How far distance am I talking to that other actor? What happened the moment before? Did the queen banish me to an island? I mean, where am I? So there's no hair, there's no makeup, there's no costumes, there's no props. So actually voice acting, the great voice actors actually deserve a lot more accolades than they get, because you're creating everything with just your voice, if you think about it. And sometimes we don't even know, like if I had a scene with Austin or Ellen DeGeneres in Finding Nemo, and I don't know how she's going to react. You know, let's say, you know, it's a scene with the two of us or the three of us. We have to do sort of different versions. Like, let's say she's going to react more excited. If it's already been put down and the director knows in advance that they've already said it very over the top or very excited, then we have some point of context. But a lot of times, especially in video games, we don't know how someone's going to react. And so you have to do sort of a small reaction, a medium reaction, or a large reaction. And in some games where there's thousands and thousands and thousands of lines, the poor director doesn't have time. Sometimes there's three studios going on to know, is this a comedy line? Is this a drama line? Because sometimes it could be both. So you do a couple of versions, and then when they edit it into the story, they'll have a zillion choices. Or is this her brother? Or is this her husband? I don't know. Mm. And sometimes they'll phone the creator and they'll go, and if they can't get the person on the phone, I'll do it like he's my brother. I'll do it like he's my lover. I'll do it like it's my dad. You know, it's just so I like the challenge. I see where Austin's coming from. But when I'm in something, I always try and find the best in that situation. And I enjoy it a lot. I like video games a little more than animation, but I love them both.
Because as Captain Phasma, you are supremely energetic, believable, emotional. I mean, it like legitimately scared me. Like you are, it's almost like you are that person. And I got to say, because it seems so difficult to do that, but that's just a specific example. There's obviously others, but yeah, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you kind of create this whole character and make it believable and make it legitimate. I guess people could say, well, that's acting, idiot. But yeah, maybe. But
Derek, I have to stop you here, because I must give credit in that particular performance, because I had the best role model ever. I had Gwendolyn Christie from Game of Thrones. And there was, to be honest with you, there was a certain quality they wanted, because she had already done the performance. So I had to kind of, I mean, I did Captain Phasma in a few different projects, and they actually, and when I did Star Wars Resistance season 2, because she did all of season 1. So think about this as an actor. I had to be really, really great. And I had to be, people had to say that was Gwendolyn Christie, not Ellen Dubin. They had to just say, oh, they shouldn't have even noticed. That's the point. So that is not one of my fortes, by the way. I'm being very honest. Some of my actor friends can be sound alike and sound like somebody, but the casting director and the editor, who was the editor of the Star Wars movie, said I sounded exactly like her. So I felt, I mean, that's a really good a testimony to what she did, because if the Star Wars editor, sound editor, said you sound like her, then I believe him. I believe him. But you know what? You get into, if you would see the posture that I adapt when I'm at the mic, if I'm playing a Captain Phasma, I will be very rigid. My body will be very different than when I play somebody who's a little flaky or a little bit more spacey. You know, the body informs, and that's why we go back to the ballet and my beginnings, informs your voice. So if you stand straight right now, your voice is going to be a little different than, hey there, how you doing? And you know, what's up? I'm now sort of wiggling around like a squirming fish here. Well, hey, you will see that your physicality will really affect how your voice is. It's not about putting on a voice. It's about how you physicalize the voice. It's kind of interesting, huh?
Yeah, it is. It is. And is the pressure there? So is the pressure there to be like Gwendolyn, or is it to kind of bring your own take to the character? Because I got to imagine there's not a lot of room, because you're trying to kind of keep it close to, you know, what she's created. And it's almost, when you hear the two voices, it's almost, it's not, you can't, it's indistinguishable. You cannot tell who is who. Yeah, it's unbelievable. I appreciate that.
You have to pay an homage to what she has created. And that was part of the challenge for me, because as I said, I don't feel I'm good at emulating other actors, but you also have to bring your acting skills in, because you want to honor that. You know, she had a coldness and a severity and sort of a very dry sense of humor. I have a dry sense of humor in real life anyway, but you know, there's a rhythm. I studied her in interviews, even though, because they didn't have any clips of Star Wars at the time. So they sent me some interviews with her, and it's going to be different because she's a lot wilder in her interviews. She's kind of fun. And
yes.
Hilarious. You know, not as stiff upper lip.
Very much like Game of Thrones, she's very kind of like stiff, the character, but you see the character crack on occasion, and you're like, okay, yeah, I get that.
Yeah. So no, this was more of a sound alike, but you had to be a really trained actor to just get the whole intention of what she was about. So it's a combination for her.
So I was sent a screener, I want to say it was maybe a month ago, a little movie called Together. Ellen, I want to tell you, I was blown away by this movie. I thought it was phenomenal. I don't know if it's been released, you know, out to the public yet, but I got to say, one of the most it just blew me away. I was not ready for what I saw.
I haven't seen it yet, but I got to work with this wonderful director. It's interesting you brought that up. I actually just heard from the woman who cast me, and she said it's a really great movie. I played the female lead's mother, voice only.
Yes, it's a pretty special the way that the plot kind of flows. I wasn't ready for it. I was like, okay, because sometimes I get screeners, it's like, okay, it's all right. I genuinely love this. I thought it was really a movie that people are going to gravitate to.
Well, I've never had such amazing. I mean, we did it sort of how we're doing this interview, and we did it via Skype, I think. This director, what she directed for that little scene for me, we must have done that about 50 different times and 50 different takes. I didn't even know I had that in me. I was like, she honestly a phenomenal director, very imaginative. And thanks. I had it. I think it's Nicole Beckwith. That was her name, Nicole Beckwith. I was just reminding myself. I like to give credit to my directors. Really enjoyed working with her. And Ed Helms. Love Ed Helms.
Yeah, it's really kind of a movie you're not really you're ready. It's like the premise is just like people love it. Like you never think about it until it's like they bring up a lot of things. I'm not going to give away too much, but
I know the plot.
Yeah,
and Tiffany Taro's in it, and Fred Malamed, who's a great character actor, and Nora Dunn. It's a really good cast of unusual. I like her because she cast unusual people, which I.
Yes, I totally agree. I have to, before, you know, I let you go, I have to get into Napoleon a little bit, Dynamite. The role of Eileen comes about because what I read was that the producers, or one of the producers certainly, was a big fan of your science fiction work. Is that accurate?
That's 100% true. This is where you never know where something leads. He worked for a famous magazine called Cinescape when they had these beautiful, fabulous, glossy sci-fi magazines. And he interviewed me about a show I did called Lex. It was kind of the forerunner of many sci-fi shows, especially Farscape and sort of Doctor Who. It's sort of a Doctor Who kind of. I think it's now on Amazon, so people should watch that, by the way. L-E-X-X, crazy show. Anyway, so he interviewed me for that show. And flash forward, a couple years later, we did a pilot, sort of like, what's that called? With you watch really low-budget horror movies and you critique them in a funny way with puppets.
On Comedy Central.
No, sorry, Science Theater, Mystery Science.
That's 2000? It. It's like 2000 or something. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So we're doing sort of a thing like that. It never went anywhere. Then a couple years later, he sent me the script. He said, I'm going to produce this movie. And I read it and I went, what the hell is this? And it's nobody at the time was asking me to do anything. And I went, I've never been to Utah. I'll go. You know, what the hell? Half suitcase, we'll travel. Here we go with the suitcase. And the rest is history. Who would have thunk it? No, I had no clue when we were doing it. I know I couldn't keep a straight face looking at John Heder's teeth and his afro haircut and his crazy moves and the t-shirt. But honestly, I love little engines that could, Derek. I was so thrilled that it resonated with people.
So this is, I mean, before I get into what I think about this movie, if you were, like, you kind of hinted at this a little bit, if you were to pitch this movie to someone, like, not, you would sound like a lunatic and get laughed out of. Like, I don't know how they got this made. Like, and the way it connects with people, I mean, the movie, finding a good comedy is rare enough nowadays, and that's, I guess, it's a topic for another day.
It's hard to do.
Oh, I can't. If you asked me, Ellen, to give you five really good comedies I've seen in 5 years, I would struggle to list them. It's not saying they're not out there, but I'm going to say we go back to 2004, and it's not that it's just this is a great comedy and funny as hell, but its heart is as big as its laughs. And somehow everything just flows like it's magic. It's perfect. Like, it's stuff you cannot teach at a film school. It's things you can't, you know, an audience couldn't give you feedback on how to improve it. This movie just works for so many reasons, Ellen.
Well, I agree with you completely. And Jared Hess, the director, and his wife, Jerusha, had this so much in their bones. This was in their lives. And remember, we shot in the actual places, the actual houses, the actual school. There was a lot of townspeople in the movie. And it was in their blood. It truly was. And nothing was forced. If you notice something interesting, and I'll remember the first day, I've done a lot of comedy on stage, and comedy generally is directed, and this is a generalization, but more as a high energy art as opposed to a slower medium. Mm. And the first thing he said to us when we got on set is, he says, I want this really slow. And if you notice how slow the scenes are in some, especially me and Uncle Rico, I'm like doing the scene and in my actor head is going, what the heck is this? What is this? It's too slow. This is not a drama. But he wanted us wading in quicksand. That's how he kind of put it, like really slow and methodical. And it works for these characters. There's something in his direction. It is kind of an anti-comedy comedy because that's not how you direct comedy. There's always a pace, a quickness. It's mesmerizing. Again, there's my favorite word today. He was very clever in the way he did it. He took his time with the comedy, which is rare. And I think, you know why it appealed to people, and I think about this almost every day because I probably get an email about it every day. If you don't think you're a nerd, then you're an idiot. I think all of us have grown up as nerds, and every one of us. And what's wrong with being a nerd anyway?
Absolute compliment.
I take it as a compliment because I grew up with that. Oh, you're a nerd. You're a weirdo. Thank you. Now I look back and go, why didn't I say thank you instead of cry? And that's what I think it teaches everybody, that you can have these foibles and be quirky and strange and weird. And, you know, I was talking to Tina Margarino about this, you know, why this movie worked so well. And we both of us agreed that we have always felt like outsiders. And I think most people do. And I think it resonated with so many people. And the characters are lovable. You said it. If you're just doing laughs, that's great. But if you got heart and laughs and you care, it's about humanity. It truly is.
Yeah, and I think that's where the movie wins almost everyone over. And before I get into a couple more points about the film, all you need to know for those listening about the director, Jared Hess, is that he listed all 181 student extras in the credits. Find me where that happens, ever, anywhere. Never.
He was grateful to every single one, and we all ate the same thing. We ate Cheese Whiz and Wonder Bread, and we squeezed it on the Wonder Bread and had apple slices. It was the best craft service I've ever had.
Yeah. and you'll never find out what time period is, right? Because it's a blend of the 90s, 80s, by Rico's van, maybe a touch of the 70s. And that's another thing that makes it so unique. And, you know, I was watching it. Go ahead, Ellen. I'm sorry.
No. I'm excited about this, what you said, because it is. You got it. You hit the nail on the head. Because I said, what period is this set in? They said, timeless.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I was watching a comedy the other day. Bad Trip. It was about, you know, it's Eric Andre. It's meant to just get laughs. But I felt it didn't have a story, Ellen. I feel like it didn't. And what I love about this movie, especially, is the last 10 or 15 minutes. And there's no really awful person in this movie. Like, everyone has some flaws and some, you know, I had Trevor Snarr, who plays Don, and he's supposedly a quote unquote bully, I guess, in a way. But even he's kind of like laughable, and you don't really buy him as being a threatening character.
Yeah, you're not afraid of him. There's yes. something, yeah.
There's just a love in the cast and a love that, and it shines on screen. And I don't know, that's, to me, it stands the test of time. And no movie could come close to this as far as if somebody wanted to remake this or do something like it, it would fail miserably because I just, there's too many X factors here that you could not replicate.
They've talked about it, you know, remakes and stuff like that. And then they did the animation series. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes. Did it. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I don't think it worked well. I never saw it, and I was actually hoping it would go on so Eileen would – and then I was getting into more voice stuff. I went, oh, I would love to do this, but it's hard. That's a tough act to follow, you know?
Yeah, and you know, you did a scene with John Grease who plays Uncle Rico. Let me ask you, Uncle Rico – is he a good guy? Is he misunderstood? I feel like every one of us knows an Uncle Rico, you know, in his 50s talking about how he could throw a football a quarter mile. We all know that person from high school. But I feel like there's a really just strangely likable quality to this man. Like, and you're cheering for him in the end when he meets the love, you know, you're assuming his girlfriend to, you know, moving forward. But like, I don't know. Is he a good guy? Is he misunderstood?
Yes. Yes. All of the above. And that's what makes him human. John Grease is probably one of the most phenomenal, underrated actors. I think he is absolutely very special. And that's very interesting that you took that from his character because, you know, underneath that bravado and that macho and that I was the high school hero or I wanted to be the high school hero and maybe he never was, I think John really captured that. And a lot of people, you know, their dreams they don't quite get there or they still have the dreams even in their 50s, 60s, 70s, whatever age group you're in. And I think he really captured that. I think that's a very, again, we go back to the heart because he had heart. I mean, even with the suave and the black hair and the funny outfits and sort of, you know, the, what do you call it? Suave. We used to joke, not suave, suave kind of look. You still felt for him, and you rooted for every character, I think.
And that's what makes the ending so special is that everyone kind of gets the thing that they're looking for, and even your character, Eileen. I mean, she has this huge heart, and you know Napoleon goes out of his way to draw this picture, and it's clearly not great. But you know that doesn't mean anything. Like you're going to call this boy, and you're I don't know that's very telling too. Again, another character, just good heart. And you really brought it to the screen. And I mean, it's just such a wonderful moment in the movie.
Thank you. Yeah, well, the bottom line was she wanted her daughter married off. So, you know, even if it was to Napoleon, who knows? You know, we talked about this a lot. And I wanted to fall in love with Uncle Rico, but they were very, you know, some people have asked me, did we have something going on? And the director was very careful. I mean, it's hard not to fall in love with John Grease as Ellen Dubin, you know, as me. You know, I like to always fall in love with my actors, just find something I like about them, man, woman, dog, cat, whatever. Unless there's got to be some hatred, but even then, that's a whole other acting lesson. But, you know, there's something very appealing about him. And the director keeps saying, you know, make sure this is not a love scene. But a lot of people have looked at us and wondering if we went off in the sunset. I say yes. Yeah. I say yes, but shh.
Yes, I agree. And the girl that they kind of set up a little bit for that to happen with, I had no idea. That's Aaron Rule's wife in quote unquote real life, the woman on the bike at the end. I had no idea.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot that. Yeah.
Two last things, one of which is the cinematography and music are just perfect, absolutely perfect. Just wanted to see any future projects you wanted to get out there. Ellen, you've been so kind giving me all this time. Anything you want to promote, get out there so people can kind of listen to it, get involved with it, pay attention to it.
Well, there's a few things coming up, and unfortunately, because of NDAs, I've got a really huge movie coming up that I've lent my voice to. It'll probably be one of the biggest movies of all time. So that I'm not sure when that's going to come out because of movie theaters and all that stuff. There's some video games coming out. So ellendubin.com is my website. They can go to that, and that's, you know, where it will, you know, be revealed. I have a lovely little movie I want to talk about quickly. It's called Boundless. It's an 11-minute short. It's a sizzle reel for possibly a series. It's about female World War II pilots. Mm. It's a true story. Women in World War II that had to pilot cargo from country to country, and these are women that most people don't know about, and this woman did a lot of research, and it's called Boundless, and it's been taking film festivals by storm. Unfortunately, we can't go. I think just in Florida. It's all over the U.S. right now, and I'm really proud of that movie because it's a subject that a lot of people don't know about. And World War II has been very – I did two World War II projects back-to-back. I did the bazillion-dollar Midway with Roland Emmerich. Mm. And unfortunately, me and the film ended up on the cutting room floor. I think I have one nod to Woody Harrelson, who we'll talk about in another time, a great actor. Mm. And then I did Boundless, a short film that was made for $100. It was interesting, but both – World War II is very important to me because my father's an older father and he was a World War II veteran. So it was interesting after he passed to book both these movies. It was very interesting timing for me as a tribute to my incredible heroic father. So I want people to look out for Boundless. And there's some video games coming up and some animation and not one thing I can talk about.
And Boundless, is that – that's not available anywhere yet, correct? Is that
not yet, but if they look it up. I think they can see when it might come on. I'm not sure what she's got planned for it, but I think it's well worth watching. It's only 11 minutes. She wants to get a series out of it or do a feature film. It's very tricky right now for new filmmakers to get things done because of the pandemic, but people are online. Thank goodness for online, and people are able to show their work. And I have a feeling it'll be out there pretty soon. So
it sounds fun. Does it play like a documentary, Ellen, or is it like a movie with, you know? Does it play out like a story? You see what I'm saying? Is it like
a story? She's used, like, I'm playing a real woman named Jackie Cochran from Florida, who was the first woman who broke the sound barrier for how far she flew and how fast she flew. Wow. She was faster than most men. Very interesting lady. That woman could be a movie in itself. But there's a frame, a story of an older pilot, female pilot, who goes back in time, finds a picture in the box, and goes back to her flying days when she's in her 20s. And that's basically the frame of the story. So it's a story as opposed to a documentary. Yeah, that's a good question, though.
Her name is Ellen Dubin. Ellen, you are what my late father would refer to as good people. And thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Derek. You're great people.